what weigardenar in yadagum fayed kuninga thrum yathrunen who the evelingers ellen fremeden off shoulder shaving shevna threatum monium meg the medicever off tear exoda era sith an eris weas fayashaf funden he thus profri abad weox under woknum weoth mindum thar or that him your wilch star satendra over fron rada heran shoulder gomban gilden that was god kuning. That is, hooray. That is the source of the title of our book, Huat, which means listen, and poets over 20 years at Ledbury have been telling people to listen in their work, and they've been asking you to listen at Ledbury. I'll just translate that into modern English. Had we been sitting here 1,200 years ago in the Mead Hall in Ledbury, that would have been the English spoken here. That would have been the English that you would have heard. English being a language created by immigration.
Hooray!
Now, Seamus Heaney translates what as so. So, the Spear Danes in days gone by, and the kings who ruled them had courage and greatness. We have heard of those princes' heroic campaigns. There was Sjöld Scheifing, scourge of many tribes, a wrecker of mead benches, rampaging among foes. This terror of the hall troops had come far. A foundling to start with, he would flourish later on, as his powers waxed and his worth was proved. In the end, each clan on the outlying coasts beyond the whale road had to yield to him and began to pay tribute. That was one good king. Unfortunately, Seamus Heaney was one of the few poets we've never had at Ledbury. Much as we tried, we never had him. And also, very sadly, another poet we've never had that we've been trying to get to come to Ledbury for years was Geoffrey Hill, who many of you have heard, has just died.
No.
Very sad news. Also on the subject of Huat, one of our contributors, Michael Rosen, went to Oxford in the 60s to study English. After which he wrote this poem called What. In 1966, delighted that I had finally turned back from my excursion into medicine, I started on a degree in English Literature and Language at Oxford. I arrived in the English faculty building to hear a lecture on Beowulf, the first and only piece of epic literature in English. A woman with a pile of notes in front of her, gave a one-hour lecture on the first word in the first and only piece of epic literature in English. What? That was the first and only lecture I attended on the course in English Literature and Language. And interestingly, also from the point of view of development of English, Beowulf was written between the 6th and 10th centuries. The Beowulf poet is actually writing in the English of the time about an epic story that related to his forebears in southern Sweden. The Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes all came from that part of Europe. And I'm going to hand over to Mark in just a second, but before I do, in the light of the past week's events, I'd like to read another poem by Michael Rosen called People Run. People run away from war. My father's uncle and his wife ran away from war. They ran from one side of France to another. But the authorities divided people up. Some who ran away were good. Some, like my father's uncle and his wife, were not so good. They were not born in France. So they were put on the list and had everything taken away from them. They heard that people like them were being put on trains and sent away to the east. So they escaped and ran across France. Again, this was a good move. They were safe now. All they had to do was wait. While they were waiting, the authorities in this place got defeated. They were seized, put on a train, put in a transit camp, then on another train to another camp where they were killed. People run away from war. Sometimes we get away, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we're helped, sometimes we aren't. Mark, as the Labour Arts Minister, we thought opened the first Ledbury Poetry Festival 20 years ago, but in fact we've now learned it was the second. one of two horrible mistakes in the book, of which more later. But no mistakes, I hope, in the poems. Mark is going to speak, and then we're going to introduce the poets in turn. We'll have four poets on the stage, and we'll ask each poet to read one at a time. Some of them are going to read a poem by another poet to give you more poems from the anthology, and those choices will include a number of poems that relate directly to Ledbury and the experiences of poets who've been in Ledbury. But one thing that would help us tremendously is don't clap after each poet, clap all four after we've had the four poets, because that will help move things along very well. So thank you, that's my bit, and I'll hand over to Mark.
Thank you, Neil. With typical modesty, Neil hasn't told you that he not only underpins everything, as you can imagine. Anybody who knows his trilogy will see the stamp of Neil in this anthology. And though formally I've edited it, it's really been a joint thing. I've been trying to persuade him all winter to say, we ought to have it written or edited by both of us, but he's hopelessly modest. And he said, no, you've edited it. But he's responsible for most of the overseas poets, which give it such flavour, I think, this. But also, typical modesty, he didn't explain that he came up with the title What. Like most people who are writing or editing books, we simply couldn't. We went round and round the room trying to find a decent title, and they were all very predictable. And suddenly Neil said, we ought to call it What. And though I'd read English literature at Cambridge, I was taught quite well by people like Gaffar Leavis and Queenie Leavis, I never grappled with Old English at all, and I always had terrific difficulty with Beowulf. So it was wonderful. I couldn't have done that, despite 3 years at Cambridge. But he came up with the title, and it's a terrific title, I think. But he's also come up with so much. I mean, we owe such a lot. You all know here in Ledbury how much we owe him, and to his trilogy as well. And it's very nice to have a chance in public to pay tribute to Neil Astley, who is just wonderful. And we wanted to make this anthology a real celebration of 20 years, because over that 20 years we have had 550 poets read here, and from more than 35 overseas countries. So we've always had a terrific tradition of foreign, both in translation and in English, poets. But as Neil said, one of the great sadnesses, we never got Seamus Heaney. We often asked him, because he was wonderful at saying yes, but we never got a date from him. But we've got the next best thing. Tonight in the audience, we've got Ike Williams, who is his literary agent in America, and it's wonderful that you're here, Ike. And if we can't have Seamus, it's good that we've got you. We had 550 poets, and we've just chosen 200 of them for this anthology. And they're all, because we wanted the receipts from this anthology, please buy it, to go to our wonderful education work. Last year we worked with 3,000 children, and we need to support that more. And so all the receipts from What will go to that. And as a result, we've asked all the poets in this either to give us a completely new poem or definitely a poem that is not collected anywhere, and therefore the royalties will come to us. We won't have to pay royalties on it. so we're very, very grateful. There are many, as you will see this evening, there are well over a dozen poets in the anthology who are here tonight, and we're enormously grateful for their generosity in donating the royalties of their poem. But as Neil said, I'm just going to finish very quickly now. I made a terrible boob in my introduction, because in naming the wonderful people who started this festival, Peter Osgood, John Burns, Martin Moxley, Richard Serman, I somehow omitted Alan Lloyd. And Alan, if you're there, I can't see you in the dark, but I am terribly sorry. I will eat humble pie, and I do apologize, because I knew that you were in at the start of it all, and I don't know how, through a typo or just simply through an awful omission on my part, you weren't put into my introduction in the poem, in Huat's introduction. So, sorry, Alan, but you were vital at the start, as were all the other people. And Peter Osgood is still chairman of our board, and is a wonderful chairman. And so, all those people and all those poets are vital. Look at it. There's some very nice memories in this anthology, as well as some wonderful poems. And there have been fantastic people. Lizzie Lockhead, who can't be here tonight because she's got a new play coming on, and Danny Absey, sadly, is dead. And George Melly, very sadly, is dead. He apparently did open the very first session, and as Alan pointed out, and I only did the second year, but I was very proud to do it, and it was a wonderful thing to do, and it was an extraordinary collection then of half a dozen real enthusiasts and lovers of poetry. And I loved coming down. It was my first, literally my first weeks as arts minister in 97, yes. And I remember it well. My civil servants dumped a file on my desk and said, "Minister, these are the things that we've accepted for you this summer, but I expect you won't want to do these. For instance, you certainly won't want to do this unknown place in Herefordshire called Lebury, who's started a new art poetry festival, so we can write that out of your diary." And I said, "On the contrary, I've been working with poets for the last 10 years, and I love contemporary poetry. I would love to do it." And they were most put out and very huffy. They wrote me an appalling speech, clearly written by somebody who'd never been to a poetry, had never read any poetry, or never been to a poetry festival. So I scrapped that and spoke here from the heart, and I love this place from day one, because all the people here, like Peter and Alan and etc., were so in love with poetry, and it was such a fantastic atmosphere. And I've loved it ever since. And so, when soon enough I fell out with Mr. Blair. No fun being his arts minister, I can tell you. He never read anything. Literally never read anything. It was extraordinary. He admitted that he never read Robbie Burns. He and I and John Smith went on a delegation to China, and John Smith, who loved drinking and talking, dumped a bottle of malt whiskey, got the ambassador to give us some malt whiskey. And so when we were locked up every evening in our government bungalow in Beijing, he produced a bottle of 8 o'clock. We had a fantastic day every day, but there was always a 5 o'clock sort of ceremonial meal with lots of drinks, and they loved John Smith's sense of humour. But anyway, John would put down a bottle of whiskey and say, "What are we going to talk about tonight? Let's talk about Walter Scott." And my favourite Scott novel is, and he said, "Heart of Midlothian," and he told us why. "And how about you, Tony?" I said, "God help us." I knew from that moment on that there wasn't, if I ever became his arts minister, it was going to be doomed. And indeed it was. horrible experience, very sadly. I did 10 years preparing for it, and a miserable few months with him. Anyway, enough of that. But there are lovely stories. You read not only these poems in Huat, but there are wonderful stories about the festival. Simon Armitage being late, John Cooper Clarke being if you can imagine him in the 1990s in Lebury, it was an extraordinary mismatch. Carol Anne, who's our lead patron now, she was heckled amazingly, and Adrian Mitch, who I loved dearly, and sadly is now dead, but he caused a terrific rumpus here. There are wonderful stories, so read the memories as well as the poems. I just want to say, before moving on to the important thing, the poets reading tonight, as I say in my introduction, this anthology would only be possible, as I say, mainly because of Neil, but also because of Brenda Reed Brown. I can't see you from up here, Brenda, but there you are. Where are you? There you are. But she worked so hard and such attention to detail on putting this, helping me put this together. It's absolutely wonderful, and thank you very much, Brenda. But the other person who everybody ought to thank in this festival is Chloe Gardner. We have in Chloe the most wonderful director. She is fantastic, and everybody loves her, and this wouldn't be the festival that it is now but for Chloe, and indeed we certainly wouldn't get year after year the Arts Council grants that we get but for her attention to detail and her charming and seduction of the Arts Council. Very important when you look at a wonderful... I think that we are undoubtedly the best and certainly the longest poetry festival in the country, but there are one or two others that are really good, like Aldborough. And Arts Council, to their absolute shame and disgrace, withdrew the grant last year from Aldborough, which is a wonderful festival. And I hope that they're not going to do the same to Stanza in St Andrews, because they are mad to undermine these good poetry festivals. Enough of that. Thank you very much, Chloe and Brenda. And now on to the poets, which is, after all, the main point of tonight. Who are the first? We're going to come up with batches of four.
And thank you, Mark, for that lovely introduction. We're going to have the poets up in fours, as I said. Could Fleur Adcock, Sarah Jane Arbery, Alison Brackenbury, and Isabel Dixon take the stage first of all? And I should add that the wonderful James Urquhart from the Arts Council is here. He had nothing to do with those decisions that Mark was talking about. And also we must pay tribute to Philippa and Sandra, as well as support Chloe so well, for Chloe on the artistic side, and Sandra and Philippa in running everything else. So first of all, Fleur Adcock.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be reading two poems. I'm going to be reading one by Roy Fisher, as well as my own. So I'll read mine first. This is a poem I wrote very recently about something that happened a long time ago in New Zealand. It's called The Sleeping Bag. But when we rolled him out, he didn't move, curled up like a bud. He'd fallen asleep, snuggled in the back of the Land Rover. And Barry thought it would be amusing to tote him up all those endless steps to wherever we were visiting, like a sack of coal over his shoulders, swaddled in impermeable down. Just hooliganism, really, a joke. It may have taken seconds, not long minutes, to shake him and shake him. Light of my life, child of my first marriage, nothing to Barry. I have some friends who lost a son that way, smothered in an airless den of feathers, which, if I'd known, but not my son, praise God. Barry could get away with most things. Kids thought he was magic. They came flocking. He was to kill five boys in his time, by negligence, by booze, by his grievous fault. They drowned, all five of them together, trapped in a vehicle, unsupervised. But my boy wasn't one of them. Let me not gloat, Lord, let me not gloat. We'd moved on by then, I and my boy. not the sort of poem I would normally read, but I wrote it. And this is by Roy Fisher. It's about his garden, which he now can't get out into, although he still lives in the village. It's called A Garden Leaving Home. One after another, the windows that made it gave up looking. The monitors cut out. No dashes for freedom, there's always management. The sky that had cared for the acre since the ocean receded began taking it back again without comment. Over a bank where 9 tall old native cherry trees had oozed, split and tottered down to pulp, the stretch of air where years of magpies bungled their nests kept not a memory of all that racket. The plot filling up fast with curved shapes, some very small, some moving, brambles arching above themselves and breaking in waves down inside the boundary wall. And above, the patch where design had planted saplings at random to develop the pretense of a little wood, rowan, field maple, hazel, goat willow, crab, walnut, sloe, had become the little wood.
And the next poet is going to be Sarah Jane Arbery, who's also going to read a poem by Kay Ryan.
Thank you. I'd just like to say before I read that I'm thrilled to be here reading at the 20th anniversary of the festival, because I read at the very first one 20 years ago, which does date me somewhat. I now have to wear glasses to read. So this poem that I'd like to read first is by me, and it is the first poem in a pamphlet called County Lines, which is a series of 9 sonnets that were inspired by my encounters as writer-in-residence for Herefordshire in 2005-07. And so it was premiered at Ledbury Poetry Festival in 2007, and this is the first sonnet in the series. I have to say, it's got one of the longest titles in the book, and it goes like this. This is the title. The next train to depart from Platform 2 is the 10:40 Central Train Service to Hereford, calling at... Actually, this dates it as well, because Central Train Service doesn't exist anymore. Found moments, glimpses, 1 minute there, next instant, lost. A flock of waterbirds unfurling paper-white wings, following the Horseshoe River into dusk. Pollen caught in sunlight, whirling in a flurry of fairy after the train, slow past Leinster Station. 2 horizons, there, spotted through rain on the bus window, a trick of the clouds above the Malverns. Another herd of Herefords, mapped with red, earth-made animal, their whitened faces grounded in the county. Breath. Look ahead. Catch sight of winter. The finger traces of sheep in snow. Frosted ice on the Wye. Apple trees in white, wedded to the sky. And the second poem is by Kay Ryan, and there's a little footnote at the end of this poem which says that Kay Ryan wrote and performed this poem at the festival in 2012, and a very pleasurable time I had of it, she says. This is her poem, The Market House, Ledbury. Like the bottoms of the great soft feet of the elephant, the ancient posts of the market house shape to what they meet. Each foot of the market house cups to its hump of anchor stone, none of them purely flat or round, so that each English oak stump took different work to ease it down. Like a patient beast, the market house has stood and stood. The secret, of course, was keeping rot away from the wood.
Thank you. And next we have Alison Bradbury.
Good evening. This poem ends in Ledbury, in 2013, one of the sunniest festivals. But it begins in Lincolnshire with my grandfather, who was one of at least four generations of shepherds. It is called 97. He had that art too, counting sheep, my grandfather, away at 10 at shows. Surprising, he could read and he could count. I spent all day high on his hills, watched clouds lift fair over the lambing hut's bent chimney. Is there a photo? Who would care? My grandfather cared for the sheep before lunch tins pulled pipe from mouth to count them as they crammed three deep, 13, 14, never missing his beat as fleeces pressed trough's edge. 97, hey, three missing. He hauled three, struggling, from a hedge. The shepherd died. The sheep are gone. Some, of course, slid onto plates. Rams were exported, blood count wrong. When the last collie was put down, the ministry bought the flock for tests. How lives must shrink. Although along the hill clouds sweep, the tin hut rusts. Out of dark spring, the swifts flash back. I watch them from a valley town. Their crying drowns the church's clock. They ride air like a surfer down his wave. Their blue is blank with heat. I scarcely know where I have been, but plant my feet on fresh ground. Count not sheep, but swifts. 13, 14.
Many of the poets are giving readings in the festival, and on Sunday we'll have a reading by three South African poets. Isabel Dixon is one of them. Tony Stewart, you'll hear in the second half. And Isabel's going to read a poem by the other poet, Gabriela Baderin, with her own poem.
Thank you. Yes, two poems now from South Africa, mine and Gabriela Baderin's home country. And the first one probably needs a little bit of background. I grew up in a very, very dark time in South Africa when the National Party had imposed the very brutal architecture of apartheid on the country, divided the country with its oppressive nationalism and its legally supported racism, and cut us off from the rest of the world. And the 1980s, when I was a young girl at school, was the height of resistance. There were a lot of uprising, and things were beginning to crumble, and the state was using ever more brutal means to try to crush the challenge. And I grew up in the Eastern Cape, where one of these activists was a teacher called Matthew Ganiwe. My father was a Scottish teacher who'd come to South Africa as a missionary teacher, and after Ganiwe's death at the hands of the police, later when I found out about it and the three other men who died with him, the Craddock Four, I spoke to my father. And my father and he had taught at two of the same schools, or been appointed at two of the same schools, but never actually met. They'd sort of crossed paths almost a few times, though my father had gone to his funeral. Late knowledge. I have forgotten the periodic table of the elements, apart from the famous few and the look of the waxy scroll of text unfurled against the science lab's wall, Earth's Ten Commandments, graphed in code. I went with my father in the night as a little girl when he was setting up experiments, sat long and studied it in fascinated ignorance. And I have forgotten basic chemistry, apart from the dancing fizz of phosphorus, and the day my father's sulphurous show and tell expelled him and the standard nines out to the quad in search of air. The same quad where I watched the senior girls rehearse their witchiness around mysterious brew, their fire burn and cauldron bubble scorched into my brain. Gudniwe, like my father, taught not far away, but then I didn't know his name. Craddock, just another dusty settlement, minor satellite to our own, all unrest pressed out to the margins. His Lingalihle Ar Umazizake stirring up a history not taught in my calm classrooms. And he was sent to prison in the town where I was born, the communist suppressed, and then so inconveniently returned. I have forgotten, if I ever read, what the Eastern Province Herald said about their disappearances. Sparrow Mkonto, Fort Pelata, Sikelo Mklawuli, Matthew Gniwe, the Craddock Four. If they printed anything at all until their permanent removal from society, that terrible permission from on high was clear. Who thought to bring the telephone wire? Strangled, stabbed, and shot. So dangerous, one killing wasn't death enough. Who poured the petrol on each face to sear away the individual flesh? What did they talk of while the bodies burned? And which one cut off Matthew's hands? What calculation was this? And what settled score? In the lab, my father readied for his class. I watched Lady Macbeth try to erase the marks, but I drive now with those men, Olifant's Hook to Bluewater Bay, the threatening and the defiant, frightened for their lives. That road, that darkest pass, these are the nights we've no will to recall, but must, how something evil always in among us was. In memory of Matthew Gniwe, Sparrow Mkonto, Fort Pelata, and Sikelo Mhlawuli. I'm going to read a poem by Habeba Badaroon, and as Neil mentioned, Habeba will be reading with me and with Tony Stewart, who you will have the pleasure of hearing from later tonight. They are really extraordinary poets and performers, and I'm very honoured to be performing with them on Sunday evening. Habeba will only be arriving on Sunday. So this is her poem, The Song of the Husband, which she's written before Johnny van der Westhuizen was also a teacher. The Song of the Husband for Johnny van der Westhuizen. At 8 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays in a class on Troilus and Cresside at the University of Cape Town, taught by the only black scholar in the Department of English, I thought I learned of deathless love and its forgetting. But years later, in the line at the post office, he said, I should have left years ago. There was so little time before my wife died. What is there now? I knew it was to us he had given those years, and some sense of belonging, because he looked like us and wielded Oxford behind his lame, like the armour we all needed. What did I learn of love in that class? Not after all that our fragile choices are eternal, nor that the fateful gift, the brooch or handkerchief, is the thing that betrays us, but that the sacrifice lies elsewhere in our most faithful acts of staying, of choosing good over love, us over her. Today, on the news of his death, I remember the end always comes too early. The end comes too early, yet love is there and deathless.
Thank you.
hear from Jonathan Edwards, Angela France, Leslie Ingram, and Sarah James. We're going to start with Jonathan Edwards, who says in the book that Ledbury was part of his poetic education, and he also won the Ledbury Poetry Competition a couple of years ago, which was one of his ways that he came to public attention. So, Jonathan Edwards first.
Hiya, it's really lovely to be here. This poem has a very long and stupid title. It's called Servant Minding a Seat for His Master Before a Performance of the Rivals, Covent Garden Theatre, 1775. It's one of my proudest achievements in life, but that title is so long that it takes up three lines in the contents page. It's about something that happened in the theatre in the 18th century, which was that you couldn't buy a seat, you could just buy a general admission ticket. So you had to guard your seat for 4 or 5 hours. And of course, if you were rich, you didn't do this yourself, you paid someone to do it. So what I was interested in was what the servant would be thinking in that 4 or 5 hours when he's guarding the seat, just before the rich bloke rushes in to take it. I do what I'm told me. What does sir need? Some pleb to take a load off, guard your seat, to sit right back and put his paid-for feet up, 3 hours, 4, sat on your hands. Governor, I'm your man. Sir, master, boss. It might seem wasted time, but it's no loss. My master is a god to me. The one thing that bothers me is Gossip John, who minds the next seat over, passes hours. Now whispering about our master's trips after dark to some house on the docks. Now of our lady's preference for cloth to silk, or how she passes like the breeze through servants' rooms which echo with her squeals. It's all a gas for John to sell or share their weaknesses, their joys. I wouldn't dare. He spills the beans and turns to me and winks. I blush and turn away and bow my head and say the thing that's often been heard said about my master by the Duke of Gloucester. His dignity, his wit. It's a relief when master comes leading his frilly daughter. Now nobody would see we're up so quick, the subtle look that flicks from her to me as master's arse slips snug onto that seat I've worn for him. I've never seen a play, but as I walk away from this performance, the sound of clapping, listen, dogs my heels. This is a poem by Paul Henry. It's a massive honour to read a poem by Paul Henry, who's one of my favourite poets in the world. This is a short poem about a tree in Hollybush, which is just outside Ledbury. So I'll read this poem by Paul. And happy birthday to the Ledbury Poetry Festival. This is called The White-Leaved Oak. Have we not longed for a simple love where silence lays its infinite fields around what is left unsaid, where the bells in the branches are enough? We touch fingers to pen cumuli. The oak has known us for centuries. We lie down in its shade, kiss and die, kiss and die.
Now, some cold comfort from Angela France.
Cold comfort. There is a comfort in shortening days, in dark at 5 and dark road shining. Rain on the windows whispers permission to bolt the door and let the curtains sigh along the rail. Outside, the pressure's low and the moon's demands are muffled in cloud. A rose bush, straggled with age, taps at the glass, and an ill-fitted door knocks a little, now and again. It's not quite cold enough to light the fire, but I'll do it anyway. Lay the kindling across paper, rattle coal from the scuffle, wait for the crackle and draw. Nothing is happening. No one is calling. And I'm glad of the night, the rain.
Jonathan read a poem by Paul Henry, and one of Ledbury's many community projects has been the Poetry Orchard. which used the poem of Paul Henry's, Windfalls, as inspiration for poets to write poems relating to apples. And one of those is Leslie Ingram.
The apple name I chose to write about is Garter. Garter. Midsummer's Eve. You peel an apple, its skin a snake, a stocking ribbon, and curl it under your pillow. In your dreams, you see me offering my life and the small stranglehold of marriage. In the morning, a soft red bruise.
And Sarah James.
I had to hightail it slightly to get here this evening. But this is nothing to the man who raced fire. He'd never seen such a horse before. The size of its flanks, black but an unending tail of orange and reds. The galloping stallion was racing his truck, jumped bushes, fences, trees, homes. His speedometer soared, and then he couldn't keep up with the pound of hooves kicking up smoke, gas tanks exploding. The stones cracked his windscreen sky.
Please thank Jonathan Edwards, Angela Carr. And after the next few poets, we will have an interval. So Hannah Lowe, Kim Moore, Daljit Nagra, and Ruth Dell.
Hello everyone. I'm going to read a poem about a guy called Phil Seaman, who was a jazz drummer in London in the 60s and 70s. And he was from Burton-on-Trent originally, but lived much of his life on Old Paradise Street, which is a road in Waterloo, just round the corner from the Poetry School. And many critics consider Phil Seaman to be one of the greatest jazz drummers that ever lived, perhaps because he was so outward-looking, looking outwards to the world, to other continents and their music to influence his own. But he was also a hopeless drug addict, had an enormous appetite for drugs, used to crush uppers onto his Rice Krispies in the morning. And in the end, that was what got him. I'm taking enormous liberties in my poems these days. So in this poem, I'm a jazz musician with Phil Seaman. If you believe I played with Phil Seaman in 1970, a Sunday night, the dog and bone half empty, Phil just keeping time with his sticks in one hand, and then when the punters flocked in, his hands a blur on the ghost notes and flams, you may as well believe anything I dream of, looking at his old album covers. How on the bus to gigs he beat a Yoruba groove on his knees or mine while the passengers stared, one knee, the hi-hat, one, the snare. Or how we drank the night down in his flat on Old Paradise Street. His record player spinning through Ghana, through Cuba. Phil just tapping his feet, or later, a fag spilt from his half-moon heroin grin. Don't you know, at midnight, I turn into a pumpkin. Rack thin in his old cardigan, drooped in his chair, but what he knew about drumming was like opening the door to let the sunshine in. Well, you might as well believe that his last try at getting clean stood on the Burton Canal with his fishing pole, or strolling the streets where the boy he'd been had thrown the windows wide and whacked his drums over the backyards and washing lines had nearly set him right. Phil's Renaissance, Melody Maker said, of the gigs we played, if you could sugarcoat the sweat, the sores, the sick. Who'd guess a nap in his chair would be the good long sleep? Worn heart, the bitter at week. Good night, Phil. There's a bright moon tonight on Waterloo, and the hiss of vinyl on your turntable, spinning, spinning, the long night through.
Hannah will be reading tomorrow with Radcock. And next, Ken Moore, who will be reading tomorrow's part of the Versopolis event.
I don't think there's enough poems about scaffolding in the world. So this is a poem about scaffolding. My dad's a scaffolder. I started writing a series of poems about him, really, and the job. It doesn't sound like a very auspicious subject, but this poem is about the kind of damage to the body of doing a physical job from the age of 16 to... He's 63 now, so he's supposed to be retiring soon, but I don't think he will. The scaffolder. He says his hands are the worst. He's lost his grip. Years of working without gloves when he was young. He'd wait for the hot aches, then the pins and needles. And once they'd come, he knew he'd be all right. Could work all day, and his hands would just stay numb. Now the cold turns the ends of his fingers white. His first fall from a house roof, he swears the building shrugged him off. A broken hip, and when it's set, one leg shorter than the other. Backache for 30 years. And who's to say it wasn't luck the second time that dropped him 30 feet and gave him broken ribs, a knock to the head that made his temper strange. Sometimes when he picks things up, they drop. The other day it was a cup, just slipped right through his fingers. The last time he fell, he thought he was done, but there's always the sky that whispers, up, go up.
Indeed I will, back to Seamus Heaney. In the sense that, I knew this would happen today, so I wrote a poem about it. I saw it beforehand. That's what poets are supposed to do, aren't they? See the future. Unfortunately, this poem's about the day that Seamus Heaney passed away. I was teaching an Arbon course at Totley Barton, and it was a Friday, so I remember that, because we did, you know, you did readings in the evenings. All the students sit around sofas, and they get up to read a poem, or the thing they've written during the week. And one of the students insisted he went last, 16th, and it was at Totley Barton, and he took us out the barn, which just never happens, very scary, and he took us out into the fields and made us look at the sky, which was terrifying as well, because I come from the city. We're not used to such an event. Anyway, it's called The Day Heaney Died. Floor spots on the end night of a poetry course, then the last student, whose performance signals we follow him off the sofas, who strides out the barn as if possessed, crossing the Totley stones to recite, what would you seek from without? We're led by his torch over grass that wears upright water. Though we're some way behind and hear him in flits, out here bare space is home to the yawning cow. One of the 16, overwhelmed by wet feet and the squelch below, sounds cheerful enough. I think I've lost my foot in a cowpat. We rise up in the still warm hill, where our guide seems on the brow apparitional, who glows us a lane to his hearth, then ends pleading. Is not the air inspired by another place, another life? Have we been dragged by the grunts, the gutturals of our flesh, tied to the customary rhythms of verse, in the valley of our own passive ascent for the usual letdowns? Except when his torch blanks, we are bawled into darkness. Our instinct is to elevate our heads and seek out a luminous speck. So we gasp to state we're upon a harvest of stars, a cascade heaven, lost for a moment in the loosening gravity. Till there, beyond the silence of breath, the brightest by far, the one in the line of the great glow, like the first light of the soul, that's become its own source. A pilot to the host, the lost, the grief sore, north.
Ruth Bedell writes in the book that when she first came to Ledbury Poetry Festival, she felt she'd arrived in poetry heaven. So will you please give us your heavenly poem?
I think it's such a beautiful place, and it's always in summer, and I know it never rains in Ledbury. There was a drizzle when I was driving here, but you see, it's cleared up. I know this poem is about water as well, but it's about two, the rivers. It's about the Amazon where another river meets it, and the two rivers run along together in contiguity. They're different colours because one's got a lot of black sand in it. I use it as an image of meeting, what happens when people, any sort of union happens. Encuentro das aguas. It is unlike anything else. While swimming, the nub of selves meeting, conflux of two rivers, the dark and the gold, Rio Negro and Rio Solimões in Brazil. The kiss, nerve ends twisting together underground, each name touched and forgotten in a time really can stand still that makes us shiver. No more Durga, she who is difficult to reach. We are a whole shaman's journey in ourselves, an invisible bridge, a quest to the interior. Any what do you think of me's dissolve in each other's dark, a promise that may never be fulfilled, but is complete each moment in itself.
Thank you, Ruth Bedell. We'll now have an interval of 15 or so minutes. Before we have more poets, I'm going to ask Adam Munter, one of our patrons and long-term supporter of the festival. A lot of our events are held out at Helen's, which is his house. Adam has written a foreword to the book, and he has very forward ideas about poetry and education. So I'd just like to ask Adam to come up and say a few words.
I like to be told I got forward ideas. I'm not sure if they're forward or backwards, but they're ideas. It's just that I believe in it. Joseph Brodsky, the Russian Nobel laureate, once said, "Man is what he reads." And reading and writing poetry, doggerel, limerick, rhyme, blank, esoteric, romantic, erotic, surreal, dirty dishes verse, is perhaps the most astonishing and satisfying ways, I think, to stretch, build, and invent one's own personal language. Putting words together effectively is hard, harder than we sometimes think. It actually requires courage, independence, to build up a vocabulary that has our own, your own personal integrity, our own imprint, our own energy, to articulate something. And finally, which will be singular to each of us. We see so clearly, listening to speechmakers, and my God, we've listened to a lot recently, haven't we? Of one kind or another, how tired, clichéd, and frankly dishonest language can become in many mouths. So when we learned or tried to tell the truth with our words on a page, in public, I think we're learning how to be independent human beings. But it's all been done, you'll say before, and particularly the kids in the classrooms where we go and send our poets. And I'll answer to you, not yet by you, not yet by me. And it is true to say finally that when we find our voices, when we find our language, we also find ourselves. In the festival's Poet into Schools initiative, we see with what imagination and power children are developing a personal vocabulary, using language that is often stark, strong, bold, and original. We can learn from them. We can also learn from this extraordinarily rich mix of poets in this 20-year anthology. Here's Brodsky again, who says, a language is a more ancient and inevitable thing than any state. So, please, be serious now and go back and buy enough copies of White so that we can put into the second edition that Alan Lloyd was one of the six and generally cheer him up because it's important. He was significant like all the others were. And perhaps we can prove that at next year's 21st anniversary. Thank you very much.
I shall also pay tribute to Alan Lloyd's readings because he... Jacob Folly.
Oh, it's so nice to be here again. And nice to be reading this evening. And I see we've got the blackout curtains drawn, and it's a beautiful night, so it's good that we're all in here. I want to read two poems tonight. I want to read a poem by Grace Nichols called Night. One of the gorgeous things about anthologies, gorgeous things about anthologies, is the way that poems kind of rub up against each other, and you know, you get to read a poem by someone on one page, and then a poem by somebody else on another. I mean, that's nice, right? So I'll read a poem by Grace Nichols, Night. Night, you who always come flooding back in the shades of your original form, but shot through now with street lights and neon, a glitzy black mother of pearl, dressed in black olive and onyx, drinking dark chocolate and licorice at the trendy Café Noir. You who can reverse yourself and light is born. But I remember when you were simply a dark astonishment that allowed fireflies and stars to glow as I stargazed with my brother at childhood's window. And you yourself bent down low to harbour us in your arms. A dark astonishment. Beautiful. Jack Self's quality. It's kind of hard to explain. Like, it's hard to explain any poem, you know, really. And maybe it's pointless even trying, but this is a poem about this kind of character called Jack Self. Nah, I thought I was going to explain it, and now I'm going to pull out of explaining it. I'm not going to explain it. But you can ask me afterwards if there's anything that catches your ear, you know, and you want to ask me about. Jack Self's quality can't be bought or stolen. Mudder hasn't bottled it. Muggins here hasn't brought it home in his briefcase. The farmer hasn't clipped its weighty foam from his blackest sheep. The hawk man with a rag of meat in his leather glove can't bring it stooping from the sky. Thomas Cat hasn't fetched it from the farmyard to lay still warm at Jack Self's feet. The dark continent Jack Self peels from the flank of a Frisian cow, ties to his ankles and drags across the flatland at midday, doesn't prove his substance. The night is made of what he needs. He moonwalks in daylight, afraid like snow he'll wane or drift before he can hold the road out front, the fields behind, and the earth in the churchyard. So Jack Self crawls to the coal shed and eats.
Sunday night you'll be treated to a live musical version of Jack Self if you come to the Helen's event. Jacob is our poet in residence this year as well. Next, who better but Brenda Reed Brown to tell us how to make an angel smile.
Yeah, this poem has nothing to do with Ledbury, although I'd quite like what happens in it to happen here one day. But anyway, it was written on a beach on a Greek island, and it's called How to Make an Angel Smile. If there were angels, then this is where they would live, or somewhere like this. Not frozen in a gloomy church, stuffed full of sin, or weeping in a graveyard, waiting for the end to begin, or standing at the metal rail of some poor patient's bed, grinning a welcome as the charts go down and down. No. Here, you see them sometimes, in a wisp of spray, a stretching dog, an aimless turtle, or hear them in cicadas and goat bells and the wind. They glint on quartz and sparkle on sand and relax each time a woman, middle-aged and lumpy, makes the brave decision to be the first one there that day to go topless on the beach.
And lastly for the section, sporting his Ledbury poetry suit, Philip Rush, who's going to read one of his own poems in the book and one by Frank Ormsby.
Thank you. Well, the two poems that I'm going to read, they both seem to have something to say about the redemptive power of the natural world. The first is by Frank Ormsby, and unfortunately it seems to resonate more and more each day. The Willow Forest. What's with the pogroms, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, the secret massacres, the mass graves, the death camps, the public executions? At last, there was nobody left. The country was empty. Survivors who reached the borders became refugees. Rebuked by that silence beyond the mountains, the victors planted willows. And in due course, the country grew into a willow forest. The trees hung their heads over a history that, now memorialized, could be forgotten. Except that the few who visited spoke of a weight that was more than gravity, a wind in the trees that stilled to a kind of weeping. My poem is called Dear Andrew, and Andrew is Andrew Fusick-Peters, who's a writer who lives in Shropshire, who took up nature photography and did a rather splendid photograph of a red kite, about which I am writing to him. Dear Andrew, there's authority in your photo of the red kite, its colours sharp as a bradawl and full of savoury words such as chestnut, umber, ochre and russet. The winter end of autumn, last year's growth, a paler shade of brown amongst the black as Newgate's knocker black. St. Lawrence was hazy when we saw her with her stilly wing and forked tail on border patrol beside the flood and the Mile Brook. But a camera cannot catch the kiteness of the kite, the muscular wrench and wrestle with the wind, the twist and flex. An invisible line binds kite to earth, without which she could not somersault and dovetail and pike in the rainbow air. This time of year, the hillsides are cloyed by rainfall, by the sounds and significance of words and syllables which seep and whisper into the valley streams.
We'd like to say a special thank you to Brenda Reed Brown, who is sitting here, without whom the anthology wouldn't have existed, because any of you know the difficulty of getting 200 poets to all give you poems. Very, very difficult, by a certain deadline, and without Brenda's doing that, we wouldn't have our anthology. So we'd like to pay tribute. Steve Frank, Brenda, Philip Rush, Jacob Polly. And when they left the stairs, we had Penelope Shuttle, Liz Stacey, and Tony Stewart. And we start off with Penelope Shuttle and the Penelopes. It sounds like a great band.
This is my 12th Ledbury Festival, and so thank you, Ledbury, for being Ledbury. It's always been wonderful. The Penelopes. I saw the Penelopes painted and named, but not shamed, on a brick wall along Calvert Street. Banksy-esque, I guess, unsigned urban art. Two young women on horseback, en face. Though I had my camera, I didn't take a photo. Cameras lie, they blunt and flatten, but I kept the white Penelopes in my eye. A few days later, it seems, in my mind's eye, they rode on elephants or camels or elands, any creature but horses. And I wonder if I go back to Shoreditch, but it won't be tomorrow. Will the Penelopes still be there, drawn by an easy, clever hand, low down on a wall on Calvert Street? And it also gives me pleasure to read this beautiful poem by Joe Shapcott. Almadine's Almadine, Fanny's Ring. A low-burnt coal in an unlit room, a wolf's eye, a grape from Aquitaine, a glare, a shadow caught in glass, a shut lid, night fog through an alley, a blood glut, busted stoplight, a beetle back, a droop dark crocus, a vein bulge, a bee mouth open, a wine-tanged palate, anger in a stone, hill heather, hurt nail, neutron star, vulval, rosary, winberry, black, red, blue.
I'd like also to pay tribute to Penelope and to Samantha Wynne-Ridicott and to Alison Brackenbury, who don't just come to the festival to do their own readings, but they support the festival year after year because they want to come and support the other poets, which I think is a wonderful thing. Our next poet isn't here. Ken Smith died in 2003. He was one of the first Ledbury poetry poets in residence. And when he was here, he wrote this poem, which we're going to hear a recording of, called Days on Dog Hill.
This poem was written in Ledbury as part of a weekend writing experiment. That Dog Hill is the hill that dominates Ledbury. Days on Dog Hill. A season of loose connections, bells and weddings through the rainy summer. I walk with my head in a crock. I dreamed of nothing. I'm into town and out, down the hill and up again, muttering wagon truss, wind brace, through the tall woods along the old pack road that no longer goes anywhere. And like the windy leaves, never still, always on the way to some thought, lost in the traffic and the chatter, the town below fading into voices off, a hammer's knock travelling beyond itself, a man shouting his name over and over, lives made from the sounds they make. These things do not connect. A yellow flower from a far-off country, linked hearts cut in a tree's side, suzure of pigeon wings, an animal threshing the undergrowth, scribble of bird song, here, here, and your secret names for me, old paint, wild root, sizzle bill. I dreamed the ridge and these massed dark roots of the yews, anger like a sudden wind, wild root.
Cut Ken, not here. many poets who you know, for whom Ledbury made their mark on him. And that phrase, Wild Root, actually then became the title of one of his last collections, Wild Root, 1998. And now, Ruth Stacey.
I'm particularly grateful to Ledbury because I was selected to be a participant in a voice coaching course. And before, I was a very nervous performer, and it was a four-day course, and it's quite grueling and traumatic, and there were tears. But by the end of it, it worked some kind of magic because it took my nerves away. So thank you to Ledbury. Actions speak. Invitations to bed are soundless. That moment on the moor, when the shrill wind shushes and the trees pull their creaks into their heartwood and watch the rooks touch beaks on their branches. Those invites laden with wetness, caught in a sudden cloudburst, goose skin and clinging gingham, the second-hand copy of Wyatt's poetry discarded on the picnic blanket. Suggested with a glance, and that subtle change of expression, the invite without words, flick of the lace fan, a handful of flowers, roses, of course, always the rose red and red and bed. You know the kind of invites I mean, when the eyes become deeper pools and you feel the slick pull. The fascination that drowning holds, seaweed wrapped around the legs, and the blackness coiled waiting like a crumpled night sky that reflects a cavernous sea lit only by those strange electric fish. And you say, you talk too much. And kiss me to stop the words boil from my tongue as I try to cling onto everything, pinning moth-wing letters down in my collection book. Silently, you show me what is louder.
So would you please thank Ruth... Tony Stewart is going to read in a single breath.
I think this poem is the perfect poem to follow what you've just heard. In a single breath. Questions are hands, running fluid down thighs, around knees falling into arch. Hands brown and warm and seeking, hands dark and safe, telling and kissing without need and want of lips and tongues. Tongues lost in palms, palms end in fingertips lost in napes and dips and bellies of buttons. Fingertips tracing, trickling, traipsing, trying, treacherous against lobe, hairline and cleft of throat. Painstakingly slow, yet urgent, throwing away names, stripping names away, throwing urgent yet slow, painstakingly throat of cleft and hairline, lobe against treacherous trine, traipsing, trickling, tracing fingertips, bellies of buttons and dips and napes and lost fingertips, in end palms, palms and lost tongues, tongues and lips of want and need without kissing and telling. Safe and dark, hands warm and brown seeking, hands arch into falling, knees around thighs down, fluid running, hands are questions.
You can hear Tony reading with Isabel Angabeba at the South African Poets Reading on Sunday, so that gives you a taste of an event you can't miss. And so would you please thank Penelope Shuttle, Ruth Stacey, Tony Stewart, and Ben Smith. And before we end with our last trio of poets, I'd like to ask Chloe Garner to come up and say something.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, thank you very much for coming this evening. It's such a pleasure to have you all here and to be beginning this 20th Ledbury Poetry Festival. So I would like to thank Mark Fisher. This anthology was his idea. It was his brainchild. Without him, the momentum would never have begun for what has turned out to be an absolutely amazing collection of brilliant poems. So thank you, Mark, really. I think Neil's been doing a brilliant job of giving you heads up as we're going along. Oh, you must see this. Ah, this one, this event is not to miss. So I hope you've been feeling the same as me, that as I've been going along, I just don't feel I'm hearing enough from each poet that I'm hearing. One poem's not enough. I want to hear more. I'm sure you all agree with me. Yeah. And so, yeah. Yay! Yeah. So we have, as Neil has been saying, lots of opportunities to hear these poets again over the next 10 days. So I really hope that you'll go back to your programmes, get that red pen out and circle all the things you missed the first time round. Yeah? So I'm going to probably give you a couple of ideas, just in case you've got your red pen ready. But the first thing to say is do come along to our party after this event. You can buy a ticket from any of our wonderful stewards. For £9, you get a glass of wine, canapes, and you get to ask Jacob Polly what his poem meant, or any of our poets, because all our poets are going to be coming along to our party to help us celebrate 20 years of Ledbury Poetry Festival. It'd be lovely if anyone who would like to come along would like to come and join us. That would be really great. So do see our stewards at the back if you'd like to do that. Help us celebrate 20 years. This is my 9th festival. I came here when I was 30. Unbelievable. Time flies. And my daughter was 1, so she's now 10. And she loves it too, of course. She used to help us stuff the programmes back in the day when you could use children, child labour. You know, but we don't do that anymore. But really, I want to say that it's our community of poets, volunteers, kids, of course, audiences, and numerous people in the town who help in countless ways and make this such a heartwarming festival to be involved with. It's just been wonderful. So, it's been great fun. But back to the reason I'm standing here, which is to say, please come along and see, Jacob Polly at Helen's. That wonderful event is also going to feature Gerda Stevenson from Scotland performing poems and to music with sort of Celtic and folk influences. So that's going to be a really lovely, contrasting evening. The spotlight on South Africa, brilliant. Versopolis, our emerging European poets, are all arriving as we speak, and their British counterparts are here reading this evening. This event was a festival highlight last year. The wonderful atmosphere created when poets are speaking out to each other and to us across barriers and borders. So in the current climate, I'd urge you to come along. I really want to see the Burgage Hall full to the rafters for this event. It's free, so come along and support it. EU funded, of course, and it should be a celebration. That's what we want it to be, so do come out for that. The Ledbury Poetry Festival has always fought against the idea that poetry it occupies some ivory tower. You know, no way. For us, poetry is all around, so you'll find it on the streets, in gardens, pubs and cafes, the shop windows, and also... please listen out for our Poetry as Protest theme, because this is running throughout the festival. 25 poets will show their solidarity with their colleagues around the world who are imprisoned or threatened because of their work. This is a partnership with English Pen, and so you'll hear poems by the poets read by their colleagues. So it's really lovely, something to listen out for. And I think you only have to read this anthology, actually, to see how engaged and political many poets are without ever compromising their integrity or the quality of the wonderful work that they write. And that's, for me, personally, reading the anthology has been one of the most invigorating things about it. So check that out when you get your copy. And the Mark Doty poem in the anthology, that's a case in point. That's a really brilliant and very politically motivated poem, brilliant. And he is making an exclusive appearance in Ledbury on Sunday. I think all the poets sitting here would urge you to go. Yeah. Yes, if you haven't got your tickets, there's another one. So there we are. We've got loads of brilliant events coming up. If you're not sure, ask me. I'll tell you more about anything. And I look forward to seeing you at the party and maybe even reminiscing a bit. We could do that. But for now, I'd like to hand you over to Peter Arscott, our chairman.
Before I say anything else, I would like to tell you that many, many years ago, John Cooper Clarke peed on my wife's petunias. Now, 20 years of poetry in Ledbury have produced memorable moments, intimate, noisy, humorous, surreal, sublime, inspiring. This event tonight is a lovely example, isn't it? A cornucopia of talent. And a feast for our ears and hearts, and thanks to the efforts of Mark Fisher and Brenda, and that genius of publishing, Neil Astley, we Absolutely. Have much of it captured forever in this fabulous what. Astley and Fisher, by the way, are now referred to in the hospitality area as the Ant and Deck of poetry. The festival has come a long way since the first tentative meetings we held at various pubs in Ledbury many, many years ago under the initial baton of John Burns. And after much alcohol, we did take the plunge. We took the plunge, actually, at Judy and Alan Lloyd's house here in Ledbury. I wanted to mention that because that reinforces the fact that, Alan, you were there at the beginning. So we were an organic farmer, a painter, a joiner, a teacher, a banker, a herb specialist, a musician, and it was the love of poetry that was the one thing we all had in common. Although, of course, there were many agendas behind the decision. Jazz to be promoted. That was Richard Serban's thing, really. Retail income to be generated. I was a town councillor then. Cream teas that had to be eaten as often as possible. That was John Burns. Poetry and the visual arts had to be explored. That was me again. But anyway, we all survived and we are still friends, though we have all gone our different ways. The very first poetry event, the first ever event of the Ledbury Poetry Festival, was the City Lights Company, the American writers and musicians, followed by the Ledbury Squantum, a poet's powwow chaired by David Hart, which included Jack Papangi, Megan Miranda, Miriam Obrey, and Ken Smith. We just heard Ken Smith. And it closed with the Ledbury Slam, hosted by Sarah Jane Arbery and Marcus Moore. In between, we had Carol Ann Duffy, Danny Absey, Liz Lockhead, Wendy Cope, John Hegley, and others. Not a bad start. Each year has been different and always excellent. Why? Because, of course, it is the volunteers who make the festival. Stewards, interns, managers, drivers, accommodation providers, shopkeepers, sponsors, especially the Arts Council, and the Elmley Foundation, and the Pennington Mellor-Munter Trust, who've been with us pretty much from the beginning, and trustees and patrons, partnership organisations, local and national, etc., etc. And, of course, let's not forget the poets. So to all of them, I would like to say simply, thank you very much.
Before we finish, we're going to go out on a roll with Karen McCarthy-Wolf, Samantha Wynne-Riddick, and Peter Whiten. Karen is one of the poets taking part in the Versopolis event, which is unmissable. Last year's Versopolis was outstanding, so I'll add to what Chloe said about that. Do come to Versopolis. And Karen will be one of the poets that you'll hear. And she's also going to read a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, who was our poet in residence a couple of years ago, and absolutely an amazing poet in residence. She didn't just do her own stuff, she went to virtually every single event in the festival that she could possibly go to, and she was extraordinary. And she has since then become a patron and helped us get Sharon Olds over last year. So, first of all, Karen McCarthy-Wolf.
Hello.
It's an honour and a delight to be here. I'm starting with a poem of mine. It's set in Brixton, South London, where I've lived since 1999, after having made a slightly epic migratory journey across the River Thames, from North London to South. One of the things that I really love about Brixton, which is sort of, I suppose, a bit surprising, perhaps, is that it's actually very green. And Brixton Hill is a hill of two halves, in a way. And on one side, you've got all these amazing chicken shops and barbers open till 2 a.m. with bass booming out, and mosques and churches, and just general busyness. And on the other side, you've got Rush Common. And Rush Common is a kind of remnant from the enclosures. And it's it used to run alongside the River Ephra, which thankfully now is not sort of above ground, because I think it was a bit stinky. But anyway, but even before it got stinky, people used to sort of make rush baskets there. So this poem is set on Brixton Hill, up on the hill. A young Bulgarian comes to clear the old mattress and carpet out of the bedroom, asks if spring always arrives so early here. The forsythia's not out yet, so things must be as they should be. There's an order to the colours. Snowdrop, daffodil yellow, forget-me-not, brash, sunset, dahlia. Up on the hill, by the edge of Rush Common, where tree-fall debris mingles with bottle tops, discarded socks, and the crows poke at the mud. The wrens are nocturnal now, so their song might be heard over the babble of traffic, rumbling uphill like a brook, inexplicably flowing backwards. They sing, these birds, to the souls drifting up above the smoke. You can only see from a distance, brown and insistent as the river. On nights when we walk, lips purple with wine, past the 24-hour shop, arguing about who said what and nothing that matters. And I'll finish with Naomi Shihab Nye's Ledbury poem. Life loves to change, wrote John Masefield, after growing up in the cobbled town of Ledbury, Herefordshire. Precise crosswalks, Saturday markets, droning church bells persist with conviction. A man said Ledbury was one of the few real towns left in England, meaning, sad to say, they don't have many immigrants. Too bad, for it was easy to imagine changing everything. Hiding out down Cottage Lane in the garden of massive white roses for more than one season. Toting a bottle of fusty ferret ale to the garden table, along with a paper-wrapped hunk of greasy fish and chips from a nameless shack down an alley where the mayor told me to go. Who knows how many lives long for us in our fading diminishment. We're still rich with appetite for a cider shop's 30 faucets, a tiny courtyard sprouting herbs, haunting the print shop, plucking sheaves of discarded margins from rubbish bin, long, thin, creamy strips, basking in disgusted teen chatter on the green by the graveyard, enjoying the air. It became my air too quickly. And then I had to leave, still thinking of Masefield, a poet who suffered intense seasickness, yet wrote about going down to the sea as if it were his favourite act. Onto a packed train, across an entire region, then an ocean, guzzling window views like some desperate addict who says, underneath every, this is mine now and I love it. I will die. I will die. I will die.
And lastly, Peter talked about the importance of the volunteers who've helped the festival over the
Not so fast.
Rewind. Samantha Wynne-Riddick.
Thank you. I've been coming to Ledbury for 15 years now, and one of the things that makes it so special to me is that it's almost like a family, it's like a kind of home from home, and there's always been a very warm welcome, and I'd say especially from Alan Lloyd and from Chloe, and I'd also like to thank Neil for inviting me to take part this evening. Well, Karen was talking about hills, and this poem is about mountains, about climbing a mountain. Climbing Helvellyn. 10 years from now, the path will look the same. Conceal the same old rocks lying in wait for the newest ingenue. It's us who will have changed, morphed from stags to men with mortgages, yet unsure how, escaping from a feeling we can't now name and couldn't gauge the weight of the day we bounded up Helvellyn. Camouflaged in tutus and pink antlers, bantering at the glances of those heading back to bills shouting from dresses to sheds that needed creosoting. Not for us, oh no, we had it all in the bag. Vodka and galaxy bars and all the blondes of England to come. At the summit, 10 women on a checkered rug, staring at how far they travelled, had just begun to pass round cling-filmed sandwiches as if they were transparent presents and point little silver flasks like wands at mountains still to climb. When we fizzed up with, "Hello, girls, having a party?" "Kind of," they nodded. "We're a support group. We're widowed under 40.
And, sorry about that, Peter. Peter talked about the importance of volunteers, and as a performer and as a volunteer, over the many, many years, Peter has been a stalwart of the festival. So would you please welcome Peter Whiteley.
All right. Oh, you infectious me fairly quickly. The end is nigh. In 1999, Joe Bell and I jointly stewarded the African poet Jack Mpanje at the festival, and this tasteful article resulted from it. Jack Mpanje is gobsmacked. His audience is homeward bound, well entertained. He's done his bit, he's back in hospitality. A slice of this, a slice of that, and Jack's in clover. Conversational, transparently impressed. "They've closed the streets for poetry," he says. And he is not far wrong. The festival's en fête, traffic diverted, barricades in place. A salsa band has just erupted Trojan style from a pantechnicon. Mood music storms the town. The pubs are full, hip-swinging crowds congest the thoroughfare. Big mamas sway, cool dudes gyrate. Babies with bulging eyes are held aloft to view the spectacle. Gangs of small boys rushed to and fro, demented ferrets wriggling through the adult mass. Somewhere next week, next month, maybe even next year, on tour in Africa or at some arty-farty South Bank bash, the mention of a small West Midlands town will jog Jack's memory. He'll slap his thighs, his chest will heave, he'll roar, "Ah, Ledbury! That's where they close the street for poetry!"
Good night.
We're going to finish now. I'm going to read a poem and then I'm going to hand over to Mark to finish off. This year, we were fortunate enough to get a poem from the anthology published in the Financial Times last week. And again, a very topical poem. And I'd just like to read this short poem by Reza Mohammadi, who's a poet from Afghanistan. And this is translated by Nick Laird and Hamir Kabir. Illegal immigrant. It is possible the sun has risen, and over the mountains the clouds are there still, that winds are driving and families arriving, and there is a sound of a party, sound of dancing, chanting, and glasses smashing, the laughter exploding in every minute, and people and happiness, and also me, with my big heart in a ship, or strapped under the truck, I'm crossing the border, and moment by moment, I'm entering with glory, England.
I think you can see what a joy and indeed a huge privilege it has been to edit this collection. And you must have felt that from the wonderful readings we've had tonight and the generosity of people reading other people's poems. As well as the Reza Mohammadi, and there are several other poems about immigrants and refugees and the political situation, and they couldn't be here tonight because they're all overseas. And though we do pay the people to read at Lebri, and despite what the Guardian says that people at literary festivals don't get paid. We've always paid, but we couldn't afford to bring people over from Italy and around the world. But if you buy the anthology, do look out for Antonella Aneda, which is a wonderful poem as well, and Azita Garayman, and the glorious Sarah Howe, who is now got a huge celebrity since she won the T.S. Eliot, yes. There are some really wonderful political poems here, and I'm so glad that you read that. I just want to end by one or two additional thanks. You can see from his wonderful introductions that he's given and the continuity how vital Neil has been, not only to this evening, but to the whole of Lebri over years. He is the most remarkable publisher of poetry at Blood Oaks, and we are deeply lucky to have him on the board. And indeed, Pamela, his wife, who has been filming this, but is also responsible for the beautiful design of what, the cover, when it came back from the printers. I was thrilled by it. I mean, and anybody who knows, and of course you all do know, his trilogy, the covers of that owe a great deal to Pamela, and they're wonderful, striking photographs. So thanks to them. You've heard Adam Munte speaking, and please read his introduction, because he is passionate about the school's work that we do. But we are deeply grateful to him and to Nellie, his wife, at Helen's, who's supported this festival right from the beginning. And it is very difficult. We've built audiences over the years, but it is very difficult to keep afloat with a festival like this. But they have kept us afloat, and they're wonderful, and thank you both very much. But finally, I want to say thank you, the audience. You are a wonderful, year after year, the audience here at Lebri not only make events come alive because of the way you concentrate and listen and respond, but you absolutely prove that poetry is alive and well in this country. And when we try and get reviews of poetry and we try and get poems into the national press, they say, oh no, people aren't really interested in poetry. And even the wonderful Guardian, who print a lot of Carol Ann's poems, time and again, they had a wonderful article a couple of weeks ago by Alex Clark, where she never mentioned Babs Literary Festivals, never mentioned poetry festivals, and they did a section on the best festivals this summer. Again, not a mention, certainly not of us, but of any poetry festival. It's so frustrating, and those of you who love Neil's and Blood Axe's trilogy, and there's a fourth one coming up soon in a couple of years' time, but you will remember his Hundred Years' War a couple of years ago, still deeply relevant because of the day being the first day of the song. And we worked so hard to try and get reviews from that, and that time and again, people said, oh, people don't want to read anthologies of poetry, we won't review it. And you prove by your interest and your concentration and your love of poetry that that simply is not true. I think we're living in a golden age of poetry at the moment. We've got a wonderful poet laureate, our chief patron here, Carol Ann, who leads poetry quite superbly. But we also, you prove, and this anthology I think shows, that poetry is alive and well and enormously relevant and changes us as people and changes the society we live in. So thank you for being you and for being such a wonderful audience tonight and throughout the years of Ledbury. Thank you very much.
And finally, would you please give another round of applause for all the wonderful poets that we've heard tonight.
Thank you very much.